The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am pleased to welcome our guests this evening. I expect you all know Madeline Dean is the Congresswoman from the 4th District of Pennsylvania, a member of the House Judiciary and House Financial Services Committees, and Vice Chair of the Bipartisan Women's Caucus. But you may not know that on the eve of the biggest professional risk of her life, running for a seat in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, Madeline Dean discovered that her son, Harry Cunahan, was battling a severe painkiller addiction. What followed was a family struggle fought by countless American families caught in the grip of the opioid epidemic. Told with candor through the compelling dual perspectives of mother and son, Under Our Roof offers a firsthand look at this public health crisis. Concurrently publishing with Under Our Roof is You Are Always Loved, A Story of Hope, a child's companion to the adult memoir. It's also an adorable picture book featuring a message about hope and unconditional love. And I'll post a link in the chat to the Joseph Fox Bookshop where you can buy signed copies while they last. Tonight, mother and son will be interviewed by the Philadelphia Anchor of Anchors, a one-man institution at 6ABC, who interviewed every president and major presidential candidate since 1976, the redoubtable Jim Gardner. Rep. Dean, Harry, Jim, thanks for joining us. The screen is yours.
So, in fact, when Madeline Dean becomes president of the United States, I can put her on that list. Is that right? Well, it's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor to be here. First of all, Harry, Madeline, how are you? Nice to see you. I look forward to the next hour of conversation and exploration. I am not a book reviewer, and I'm certainly not a book salesman, but let me say that I thought Under Our Roof was riveting, and I don't use that word lightly, just incredibly candid, and in many ways, extraordinarily artistic. I love theater, and when I was reading this book, for some reason, I was envisioning much of what was said being played out on a stage. I don't know that that's what the authors intended. I think probably not. But these chapters are filled with a kind of drama that only comes with an uncompromising honesty. And if there is one word to describe this book, I think that would be it, honesty. It's one story, Harry's descent into addiction and Harry's ascent into recovery, but told in two different voices, mother and son, again, brutally honest and frankly, often heart-wrenching. Harry, for someone who wants to know what this book is about, how would you describe your journey in your words as told by you in the book?
So in terms of, you know, what the baseline of the story is, and in many levels, it's, you know, it's a mother and son love story. You know, it's a journey through some really difficult and dark times for us. And really, you know, in many ways, it's a story of redemption. I think, you know, for us, it's a story about an issue that is so incredibly common. You know, when we look at opioid use, we look at substance use disorders in all the forms that they come in. You know, it's a book about the family dynamic and showing how the disease of addiction really is a family disease. It impacts everyone involved. And more than anything, I think we really wanted to highlight what is recovery and what does it look like? You know, how is redemption through recovery possible? Because I think so often we hear the stories, the horror stories of, you know, how many people are sadly dying to this disease. And we don't see enough about the reminder that it is a treatable disease and that recovery is possible. Recovery can be challenging, but it's a beautiful, beautiful process.
I want to ask a question that you might think is inane or dumb. What is it like to be addicted to Percocet?
It is a miserable, sad, and small life. You know, for me, it was a place of hopelessness for many years. you know, it starts out with this euphoria that for me felt like it took away all of the anxiety, the fears that I had. And very quickly, the drug use and the chasing of that just consumed me to a point where I was using against my will. I didn't want to use anymore. And I felt like I was incapable of stopping.
So in the book, you said I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, I was just going to say it's at its core, it is a hopeless and feeling and seemingly hopeless way to live.
In the book, you said you felt your life shrinking. What did that mean?
So I grew up, you know, with an amazing mom, an amazing father, you know, with just, I could see potential being fulfilled all around me. And I had these big dreams as a kid. And as my drug use got worse, my worldview began to shrink to a point where I believed I was going to die an addict. And I didn't think that there was anything that I could do in order to change that. So I had no big dreams. I had no hopes. You know, I was just trying to just survive.
Madeline, and if it's all right, I will call you Madeline. I was trying to figure out if I should refer to you as Madam Representative, but is Madeline all right?
Yes, Jim, I told you, I prefer Madeline or Mad.
What is your story in this book, your plot line, if you will? What is the mom's story here?
If you don't mind, I'm going to take a step back and say thank you to you, Jim. Thank you for wanting to host this conversation tonight. Thanks for reading the book and finding something in it. And thank you to the Free Library. I have to admit to you, 3 years back, 4 years back, I never would have imagined that Harry and I would have authored a book and the Philadelphia Free Library would host us and you'd be moderating the conversation. So I'm just breathing that in, if you don't mind. And I sincerely thank you and Andy and the library. I think, I hope in this story is that people might see themselves in me and in our family and in our struggle. Battling with Harry, we wanted to be as honest as possible, but me battling with Harry, trying to find out what was wrong, what was going on with him. Why was he becoming hollowed out? He was this young boy of extraordinary enthusiasm, talent, heart, gifts, and he was just becoming sicker and more hollow and flatter in his affect. So I think we wrote it thinking maybe somebody will see themselves in us, in our struggles and our stumbles, but also in the hopelessness. And then the idea that, no, it's not hopeless. Regardless of your struggle, it's not hopeless. Raise your hand. Somebody will want to help you.
Is that why you wrote the book? Is that what motivated you to write the book, to help other people?
Yes. And I have to tell you, Jim, I don't remember if I told you this or not, but this was not our idea to write the book. It was my eldest son, Pat, who had written a book a couple of years earlier because of his work in the Obama administration. He wrote a memoir, West Winging It. And his agent came to him and said, Pat, you know, it's a couple of years since you wrote your book. Do you have a second book in you? And Pat actually said to his agent, no, I don't. I'm thinking you might want to hear my brother and my mother's story. They have a story to tell. That's how we came upon the idea of writing the book. Harry and I never thought of it, but I have to admit that I think, Harry, you and I immediately seized on the idea. And the process was, Jim, we wrote it. We created an outline together and wrote it separately. I was worried that my memory would be skewed by whatever he had in his own memory. And then both our eldest son, Pat, and much more importantly, the editor dovetailed our stories together. And you saw in the book, we have even different fonts. We kind of immediately seized. We would have different fonts to signal voice. And so I didn't know the depths of our difficulty until I had the chance to read Harry's side.
That's amazing. I have a question for Harry. You brought up Pat. And I almost feel like I'm intruding or I'm invading privacy or getting into sensitive areas, except that you wrote about it in the book. So I suppose it means that we can talk about it. You felt, Harry, that you had to distance yourself from Pat. And there was a very clear indication that there was some discomfort that you felt in that sibling relationship. What was that about? And did that in any way, do you think, contribute to your sense of alienation as a young boy?
Well, first I'll say, because I know Pat's watching, there's nothing more that he could be happier about than having this conversation pivot to him and the shout out to his book. So
that's true.
You know, so I'm sure he's thrilled and probably texting right now. But, you know, in terms of what you talked about, it really goes back for me to kind of that shrinking world. Pat was someone who was meeting and exceeding expectations. He was doing very, very well. You know, and as the drug use started, and even as in as many senses before that, you know, I had this inner fear that maybe I couldn't live up to those same expectations. So I figured one of my driving reasons initially as a young child was if I do things differently, you know, I might not be compared on a level playing field. And, you know, it was a way to hide in plain sight almost.
As long as Pat is watching, I also read his book. And I feel like I've read the whole Kunon family here. Madeline, you've got to write a book. So, you know, we can make, and PJ has to write a book so I can cover everybody in the family. So many pages in this book are filled with painful experiences, and nobody would fault either of you for wanting to take these memories and experiences, put them in your past, put them in some kind of a bury them in a personal vault so that you never had to deal with them again. By writing this book, you kept them very much part of your present. You kept them, that experience very much alive. How hard was that during the process of writing this book? You had to relive some of the most painful experiences that you could possibly imagine. Madeline, you first.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I remember when we talked with our editors early on, they warned us. They said, if you don't find this difficult, it will not be a very meaningful book. It will sound like Dear Diary. And I was a little puzzled by that at the time, but I thought about what my father used to tell me. My father was a talented writer, and he said, writing is thinking. And so as I wrote, I realized I was thinking through and processing what we had been through. I had spent years wishing this had never happened to our family. And thankful, just so thankful that Harry got to recovery. But actually writing the book was a gift. It was a painful gift, but it was a gift because I learned an awful lot. I learned a little bit about myself and my own weaknesses. I learned a lot about Harry and his strengths. And I learned what the process did for our family. The process, as painful as it was, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody. I'm very happy to tell you that Patrick and PJ and Alex and Harry and now our daughters-in-law and grandchildren, in some ways were stronger for it. Again, I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but the writing was painful, but positive.
Harry, what about you? How painful of an experience was it to actually write the book?
I'd echo that. I mean, for me, what I held on to throughout the entire process was, you know, what we talked about and why did we write the book? And that was to help somebody. You know, if we could offer some hope, some perspective, some understanding of the disease of addiction and recovery, you know, then it would be worth it. To go back and relive many of those moments was incredibly painful, but at the same time, you know, from my side, having lived it, processing it, working on what I had been through for the previous, you know, years in recovery before I started, I had been pretty comfortable in processing a lot of it. And something in full transparency that, you know, really helped me was when we did it, sort of writing separately, you know, doing it and keeping that in mind of, you know, while I was writing, I was just writing to get to the truth, and not necessarily trying to focus on sharing it out with everybody, but just focus on what happened, you know, what really happened. And I think through that level of honesty is the only way that you can show what not just addiction, but what recovery looks like and how meaningful recovery is, because I don't think you can understand recovery if you can't understand the other side of it.
When you read the book, and I pose this to both of you, there are a number of markers along the way. The golf course party, the dean of Harry's school calling you, Madeline, with Harry sitting right in his office to inform you that from the dean's standpoint, he was sure that Harry was getting high. The crisis over Harry's allergic reaction, the birth of Aubrey, Little Creek, Karen, and then Little Creek. The folks who read this book will become familiar with these events and the emotional impact of these events. But if you had to point to one thing in this book and in this life experience that maybe turned the tide, what would it be? Harry?
So in terms of what turned the tide, I mean, the most painful experience for me was the time after my daughter was born. So when Aubrey was born, I was young and I was completely caught up in active addiction. And when I remember the day that I found out her mom was pregnant, and I had this small glimmer of hope for the first time in a long time that, you know, maybe this is going to be my reason. You know, if I have a child, I'm going to be the father that I want to be. So the most painful moment for me was really that entire year after she was born, because I knew every step of the way that I did not want to be using drugs. I did not want to be the person that I was. And I promised myself night after night that I was going to change. I was going to do something different. And after not doing that, continuing to struggle, I was incredibly broken. And fast forward, I had the opportunity to get incredible treatment at Karen Treatment Centers. And actually this guy over my shoulder here is mentioned in the book. He was Father Bill. And one small phrase that he said to me, and I'm sure he said it to just about everybody who had been through Karen, but he came to me and he said, "Harry, you're not a bad person trying to be good. You're a sick person trying to get well." And that moment for me really started to open up the door to maybe this is a disease. Maybe there is something here, and just maybe there's hope for me, because I hadn't felt that hope in years. So that's really, I think, one of a handful of things that opened the door and got me on my way toward recovery.
I'm going to ask both of you to respond to some quotes later in our conversation. But Harry, you mentioned the birth of your daughter. And in the book, you say that you talked to Aubrey, obviously when she was too young to understand what you were saying. And you said, "Please help me." Then you say in the book, "I whispered to her through tears, 'Help me be better for you, to be the father you deserve. I begged my daughter for the strength to stop using, but I couldn't do it.'" It's very powerful. Madeline, if you had to point to one thing in the book that, I mean, it's hard to say there was one thing, but when I asked that question, what would your response be to either a tide turner or something that made, you know, as much of an impact as you could bear?
You know, I'm thinking, Jim, tonight, you don't know this, but tonight is my husband, PJ, and my 37th wedding anniversary. And so that's why I was really kind of delighted that you and Andy chose this date. And I say that because it's interesting what Harry just said. He wanted to be a different person. I wanted to be a different mother. I didn't like the mother I was, constantly in combat with Harry. As he was falling farther and farther into addiction, I was falling deeper and deeper into a battle with Harry to try to figure out what was going on and what was going wrong. Two things turned the tide on me. One was a friend who had coffee with me. It was months before I figured out what was wrong. I had a serious belief that it was drugs and it was addiction, as naive as my notion of addiction was at that time. And I met her for coffee. The coffee lasted, I think, 2.5 hours. It was ridiculous. And I remember being angry and upset and worried. And I said, you know, "Harry's hanging with these lousy looking kids and they just look like they're abusing everybody. I'm on to them." And she caught me up short. She said, "You're critical of his friends. What do his friends see in him? What do you think their parents are saying about Harry?" And I thought, I couldn't see the lens. I couldn't see my own son in the depths of his hollowed out nature from addiction. I was just critical of others. So that was one thing that just hit me in the head. And then, of course, the important turning point was when, after trying so hard to figure out what was wrong, we figured out that he was stealing from us. And I thought, if we can show this to him, and if we can just simply say the words, "Will you get help? Will you go to help?" That to me was one of the most joyful days of my life.
Madeline, it's an obvious statement to say that politics in 2021 is a nasty business. You have, with this book, invited the kind of public scrutiny of personal stuff that most politicians would do anything to avoid and to hide. In deciding to write this book, you obviously came to a point in the process where, or I should ask you, did you come to a point in the process where you asked yourself if this book would damage your political career?
I think I worried first about Harry. If this had come to us, if the idea had come to us and Harry was newly into recovery, I don't know that I would have thought it was a good idea. I thought first of Harry and the significance of his recovery. I think I'm a little naive in that I don't think I originally really asked that question, but I'm not naive at all. I'm eyes wide open that politics is a nasty business and you can get criticized for your haircut, you know, the suit I'm wearing, criticized for things that aren't true. But I have to believe that I go back to what Harry said. Immediately we thought, if we can help somebody, it's worth it. And so to me, it's been really liberating to say in an unafraid way, and again, this might be naive, Jim, but in an unafraid way, if you criticize me for what my family has been through with the disease of addiction, that'll reflect worse on you than it will on me. I'd rather go through this journey with greater honesty if I can help somebody else learn from what we learned.
What about when this whole story was unfolding? Harry's descent into addiction, as I think you made reference to before, was happening as you were running for state representative in the 153rd district. Was there ever a point where you and PJ worried that your family's trials could turn into oppo dirt for your opponent, that it could be used against you in that specific campaign?
Yes, and I remember that literally the day, it was October the 30th, 2012, literally 1 week before the general election, where I was seeking re-election to the state house. I had won a temporary, a partial seat when Josh Shapiro went on to county government. So I was state representative for about 6 months, needed to run again in order to secure my own full session. And it was literally 1 week before that we confronted Harry, and Harry was headed to recovery. And I remember calling the second people I called after we called Karen Treatment Center and set all that up were my campaign team. And they came over, the two of them, Kathleen and Mark came over, and I told them where we were. I said, you know, I've been worried about Harry. We figured it out. He's going to get treatment. What do I need to worry about with the campaign? And they said, don't worry about a thing. We got this. Keep going. Get Harry in, securely into treatment. We got this.
There are a lot of Marks in your story. The Mark you just mentioned, the Mark who I believe was the dean at St. Joe's Prep, and the Mark who was one of your friends, Harry, once you started taking drugs. One of those bizarre coincidences. Harry, did it occur to you that you were putting your mother and your family at risk of exposure as she was running for state representative? Again, politics is such a nasty business. Did it occur to you at the time that you were putting your mom at risk?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, going through writing the book earlier, maybe even, you know, earlier so than my mom recognized that political risk, I had been thinking about it. You know, I knew my mom was passionate about getting into public service and, you know, finding her way in a new career path after leaving, you know, her job as a professor at LaSalle University. And I knew exactly what I was doing. And I knew, you know, we had received plenty of other negative campaign mailers about my mom and, you know, they were grasping at straws. So I was terrified that I might be the reason that they had something, you know, that they had something concrete that could impact her, because, you know, more than anything, I just didn't want to take away this opportunity that I knew she wanted so badly and I knew she would be great at. You know, and that I think led into even more of that feeling of the stigma and the shame and not wanting to ask for help, you know, which I think everybody can, who's been through it, can relate to. But I think for me, it really magnified that fear.
We know what your mom is doing these days with her time. What are you doing with your time other than writing some very compelling books?
So I'm incredibly fortunate. I was able to, you know, for the last little more than a year and a half, have had the opportunity to go back and work for care and treatment centers, and really work in a career and in a field where I get to be hands-on and play a part, you know, even if it's a small part, in trying to help others access treatment, understand what treatment options are, and really just find resources. And, you know, for me, when I was living in active addiction, I was afraid to ask for help. And I had no idea what was out there, you know, in terms of a recovery community, in terms of treatment options. And I've been overwhelmed since I, you know, entered into this field and have started working, you know, for Karen, just to see how much is out there. And I know, you know, my mom will always add also, we need more, right? You know, we need more access to treatment, you know, and treatment can come in many different shapes and sizes, you know, and it needs to be individualized. But I just love being able to work in a field where I get to do something I'm passionate about, something that I believe in, and feel like I'm making an impact to try to help and offer somebody, you know, some of the gifts that I have received through recovery.
You write in the book that when you were at Karen, and you were glad to be there, or you knew that you should be there, that you were still gaming the system a little bit. You know, like on family weekend, you were still in describing the timeline, which is something that you had to do, were still explaining to your parents only that which they already knew. And you were avoiding any new revelations that would have explained how desperate your situation really was. Now that you're working for Karen, what are you doing to have others buy into that process even more than you did? And forgive me, I should say that when you went to aftercare at Little Creek, that's really where the epiphany came and Harry bought in 100%. But in terms of your work at Karen, what are you doing so that others buy in even more than you did when you were there?
So, you know, in terms of my day-to-day work, I'm not part of the clinical team. So, you know, I'm not trained in that way to work really hands-on with patients who are in treatment. But, you know, in terms of my role, it's really helping families kind of understand what is available. You know, when I get to talk to prospective patients or their family members, it's, you know, just trying to shine a light on that this is a treatable disease, you know, that there is great treatment available. There's evidence-based practices. We've seen it work. You know, so I'd say that's much more my focus. I'd love to be, but I'm not, you know, trained in that way to be that hands-on.
Madeline, what is it, or is there a possibility that your experience with Harry's addiction has made you a better public servant? Do you think?
Well, I could hope. I know it's garnered in me a passion around substance abuse, around addiction, and around mental health. I already thought I had that, but I recognize that I've learned so much through Harry. I have to really tell you that. What I recognize is it helps me focus my passions. So it's one thing for us to sit here and tell you how Harry had access to this terrific treatment and long-term treatment. But it's quite another when you see the stark reality of our healthcare system, how we put to aside mental health, how we put to aside substance abuse and addiction how we shroud it in a stigma and a shame. And so that's why I wanted to try to just fight those odds and fight the shame and the stigma. And literally, it's helped me, and Harry has helped me come up with legislative ideas, initiatives, literally acts that we have introduced, bills that we have introduced around healthcare, around stigma, around the criminal justice system, because we know how unfair that can be when treating people with mental illness and addiction. So I hope it's maybe a better public servant. Something I wanted to tell you, Jim, is that as we wrote this separately, I didn't read any of Harry's until we had written half the book. And so what I want others to know is I didn't know the depths of where we had been until I read Harry's words. I remember early on, it was chapter five. It's no longer chapter five, but I would say to Pat and Harry and to PJ and Alex, I'd say, I can't even believe, I can't even read the words. They're so painful of how far addiction can take you. And so we're here to try to say that the life of an addict is so very difficult, and people have to have greater understanding of what this disease of the brain can do and how it can pull you away from your family. So I hope it's maybe a little bit better public servant and a little calmer mother too.
I want you both to respond to just a couple of quotes, and then we're going to open this up to a Q&A. Madeline, upon realizing that Harry was stealing money from you and PJ, you write in the book, "I sat in the car and called PJ. I know it's drugs," I said when he picked up. "Harry is stealing money from us. That's why I can't pay American Express. There is something uniquely desperate about a son stealing from parents who are willing to give him everything."
It's a really hard, dark day, because not the loss of the money, but the loss of trust, the utter shattering of trust. No, my husband, PJ, his favorite expression is, "What's mine is yours." And so to get to that point where, number one, Harry, in the depths of what he was dealing with, didn't feel comfortable coming to us was heartbreaking. But also the theft from your own parents is a shattering moment. And I worried, Jim, at that moment, would we ever dig out of this hole? Right? Now, would we save his life? Would he be able to save his own life? But would we dig out of the hole? And I hope you saw in the rest of the story that that trust has been rebuilt in immeasurable ways.
In fact, at family weekend, at Karen, Madeline, you said fears, relapse, arrests, stealing, sickness, flunking out of school, never having a job, one last fear, death. Deep down, I was afraid Harry was going to die.
They did an exercise with us using whiteboards, and all of the parents and the siblings participated and said, just list your fears. What are your fears? What is it you've been thinking about? And I literally watched as everybody put that list together. It was kind of like a building blocks of fears in different colors streaked onto the whiteboard. And I thought, if I'm going to be honest, it's going to be much more than he doesn't get his college degree. It's going to be much more. So that was the final word I put at the top, death.
Harry, when you came back, I believe after Little Creek, correct me if I'm wrong, you were in the shower. And you write in the book, "As the water rushed over me, I suddenly realized that I had gone through the entire day without wanting to use. I couldn't believe it. Not only had I not felt the desire, I hadn't even thought about drugs at all. The desire had been lifted. The miracle had happened."
I remember that moment vividly still. And I think, you know, when I was introduced to the idea of recovery, people had told me that that was a possibility, and I couldn't see it. I couldn't believe it. You know, the first half of the book, you see just how consumed my life had been with getting and using drugs and just consuming every part of who I was and what I did. And initially I started to have hope that maybe I can stop, You know, that was sort of the original hope. Maybe I can put this down. But I wasn't yet sold that I could be happy or I could not be obsessing or, you know, having those compulsions anymore. You know, for me, that's really been the miracle that has given me a foundation and an opportunity to do so much more with my life has been seeing that, you know, seeing something that I didn't believe was possible happening in my own life. And now being in recovery for, you know, a little more than 8 years, the blessing is being able to see others, you know, go through that same experience, coming in, feeling hopeless, broken, and then seeing that sort of light come back on inside them and see them grow. You know, it just reminds me on a daily basis of what is possible.
Let's go to some questions. And there are a bunch. From Jane Slater, do you feel that parents can do anything to prevent drug use in their children? Madeline?
I don't know. What I would say is that parents can educate themselves and then as age appropriate, educate their children. Because I think the more and more that society recognizing that the possibility of having the disease of addiction might enlighten people in terms of experimentation and other things. So I feel like education and openness is the best we can do. And I say that as somebody who actually thought I knew something about this before we recognized what was going on with Harry. I thought I knew something about mental illness. I thought I knew something about addiction. So I wish I had known a little bit more. So I would suggest to parents, just arm yourself with the truth and the facts and the research and the data and guide your children as best you can.
Michael Shore, did medication, this is to Harry, did medication assisted treatment play a role in your recovery?
Not in mine. But I know many, many people where it has and has been such a great value and tool in terms of helping others. So while for me personally, it wasn't part of my story, I think it's an area that, you know, for many good reasons is continuing to grow. And I hope to see access to it and availability and support and understanding of it continue to grow along with that. Because in terms of the evidence and what we're seeing, it works. And we need to accept that and offer it more widely than we are currently.
Ellen Furstenberg asked the question that I wanted to get to, but I'm glad that we're dealing with it in the Q&A. She says, I know from seeing you on PBS that you are quite aware that you are privileged and that helped you get through it. I give you credit for that, but besides the book, are you doing anything for the many addicted people lying on the sidewalk at Kensington and Allegheny who do not have your options and advantages? Harry, you make an absolute acknowledgement in the book that your privilege helped you get away from police charges on numbers of occasion and also helped you in the larger picture. What about what Ellen Furstenberg has to ask?
So something that I, you know, unfortunately right now am not able to do, but something that I did for quite a while and found incredibly valuable was I volunteered at CFCF, or Kern-Fromhold Correctional Facility, to bring meetings into the inmates there. You know, I write about kind of the thought process of doing that and, you know, some of the fears of someone who, myself, never being arrested. What can I do to give back? But I knew I had to do something, you know, so that was something that I hope to be able to do again. It was incredibly valuable and rewarding. And, you know, I know for me, every time I was there, you know, the bars that separated us on the way in and the way out really came down when we were able to be there and talking about addiction and recovery in those meetings. You know, and otherwise, just in the recovery work that I do in terms of meetings and otherwise, I try to help as many people as I can.
You write very powerful. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Madeline.
Can I take a shot at that? And I thank Ellen for that question. We do write in the book about we recognize that white privilege shielded Harry, shielded us from a lot that society doesn't shield you from. You know, I have said in some of these interviews that the disease, we weren't privileged from the disease of addiction, but certainly our socioeconomic status, likely the color of Harry's skin. He also looked extremely young while he was engaged in all of this difficulty. A lot of that kept him without a criminal record. When we went to Karen, it was stunning to see so many others who were lucky enough to get there were also struggling with criminal records. So we get it. Certainly skin color played a huge role. To your point about K&A, I've been there a couple of times, and it reminds me of Brian Stevenson, who's just such a brilliant lawyer and advocate and civil rights leader, who said you have to get proximate to the problem. You got to get close to it. And so in part, I think that our writing of the book was an attempt to get proximate to the problem of addiction, but also the problem of how society deals with those who are addicted. And also it's helped inform me in terms of what I'm trying to advocate for and change of policies around healthcare, the ability to get treatment and to get treatment even after you relapse. You know, the cliche is that, for example, if I had cancer and I went to the doctor and I was treated for cancer and I had a reoccurrence of that cancer, likely the doctor wouldn't turn me away and said, no, I helped you the first time. Our healthcare system too often doesn't either offer you the healthcare or offers it too short or turns you away in the event of relapse or reoccurrence. So Ellen is absolutely right. There's so much more we got to do. And I feel that within inside myself.
Madeline, is Graham Dean your niece?
Graham, is Graham on here? Graham is my nephew.
I'm sorry, your nephew, forgive me. Well, Graham has a question.
Nephews.
Graham has a question.
Hello, Graham.
Aunt Mad, as a former educator, have you thought about sharing your story with students in Philadelphia?
Oh, Graham. Graham is an educator himself, as is his wife. And that's Harry's first cousin, who read the book early and devoured it, as he said. I would love to take this book on the road to students, no matter what part of the city, the suburbs, the counties, the rural area. We just are really of the belief that if anybody can see a little bit of ray of hope in us and in our story, we've done our job. And in the Jewish faith, they say to save a life is to save the whole world. If we can save somebody, some family, we will feel very fortunate to have passed this way. So Graham, thank you for the question. Invite me to the school.
From Kathleen Leshinsky. Harry, was there anything that some could have done when you started using that did not happen?
I don't think there's one particular thing. I think one thing that as a society we need to work on and to look at, is I did on my own recognize that I had a problem well before, I was able to get treatment. But the way that we talk about it, the way that substance use disorder is portrayed in the media and movies and elsewhere, there's a great deal of stigma. That there's a lot of effort to try to improve, and I think we're getting better. But I think just as a society, as a culture, as human beings, we need to look at how we talk about this. We need to talk about all sides of it, recovery, to understand it, to the treating of it. I think maybe if that was different and it felt different from a cultural standpoint, I might have been more willing to stick my hand up and say, hey, something's wrong. But I don't think there was one moment, that I could identify that necessarily would have changed it otherwise.
And Cowles asks, what kept Harry from going to his parents for help? Any advice for parents on how we can encourage coming for help?
Harry, I actually think you should go first on that.
Yeah, I think for me, again, it's, it was really the shame, of how I felt, and how I thought I would be viewed, right? Because living the way that I lived, you know, I knew what was right and what was wrong. I had been taught. I had the sense of morals and who I wanted to be, who I thought I could or should be. And day after day, I couldn't live up to them. And I hated myself. And, you know, I didn't want to put that burden and expose who I was for two reasons. One, because I was ashamed. And two, because I didn't understand what recovery looked like, what treatment looked like, and what was actually possible. So I think it was the shame, but also the not knowing what was out there for me.
You know, there's a quote from the book that's really relevant to this. You say, "I hated hurting Mom, but our worlds were so far apart, so I took the easy way out. I lied."
Yeah.
When you hear that now, Harry, how does that make you feel? I mean, those are your words and obviously a shared experience between you and your mom in a way that, you know, would have been great if it had never happened.
So the first thing I'll say is, you know, something someone told me early in recovery, which is a, you know, cliche or expression that I just love, right? You know, I was told early on, you know, in recovery, you get to live two lifetimes in one lifetime. So when I hear that today, it's so far from who I am now and, you know, the value set that I live by today. But I also remember being there, you know, and feeling that way. And, you know, it shows how scared and small my world was of, you know, what I thought the response would be. In the book, we talk about my mom wrote me a letter on the day that I went to go get help. And she wrote in that letter something that I could not possibly imagine. She wrote that, "I'm proud of you." You know, on a day when I felt more shame and more guilt and more remorse than I had ever felt, she wrote that she was proud of me. So, you know, it shows my lack of understanding, you know, and as a parent, you know, to two children now, I've got a third on the way. It's just, it's a world, I'm a world apart from where I was when I felt that.
There's a quote I want to read, which will lead me right into Kimberly Taylor's question. Madeline, you say in the book, "You earned trust in drops and poured away in buckets. Could we trust him again? When Harry came home, that was the biggest question." Kimberly Taylor asks, "Trust is such a loss for us. What can we do as parents to encourage or allow our son to rebuild the trust?"
Oh, thank you for that. And that expression Harry taught me after he came home, but it was on my mind, as I told you, from that moment I discovered the bank statements and the loss of the money, and I knew it had to be Harry, and I knew what it was for. That broken trust. What I can say is the mending of trust and the path back is through brutal honesty. And that's something Harry was willing to be a part of. It doesn't happen overnight. It didn't happen overnight. In his recovery, he was, as I said, sort of guarded, but becoming more and more honest with himself and with us. And then ultimately, I want to tell families, because I know so many families who are torn apart by addiction. And the biggest breach, probably, other than health, is the trust. You think that bond is broken and maybe it'll never, ever be remended. And I just want to tell families, it not only can be remended, it can be stronger than it was prior to addiction. I am certain that my bond with Harry and really, frankly, our whole family is stronger because of the brutal honesty of what we've been through, and also just sincere admiration for Harry and the hard work. This is not easy. Recovery is not easy. It is an everyday event. It, as Harry describes, it lifts and it becomes easier over time. But we're all keenly aware that this is a deadly disease. Every day matters. But I do want families to think and know, I promise you, trust is a powerful thing that will and can be rebuilt.
I know in the shower that day, Harry, you said the miracle had happened. that you went a day without thinking about using drugs. But are you still dealing with your recovery even now, all these years later? Is it still an everyday thing for you, as your mom says?
Absolutely. It has gotten tremendously easier in many ways. My life has become so full and so rewarding and fulfilling, you know, in terms of my family, my work, and just how I feel about myself. So it's not that minute by minute struggle that it was in the beginning, but it is something that I need to stay active and continue to work at. And that's, we wanted to highlight through the book again, kind of the process, because I think in other things that are out there, there's maybe this sense that you pull the alcohol, you pull the drugs away, and all of the problems go away. And I think, you know, if we want to get real about what recovery is and what it looks like, it's a process. It's a process of healing, and it's a process of growing, you know, by all of those habits, the lying, the stealing, those are things that you work on. And over time, in terms of rebuilding that trust, you just do small things, and you do them well, and you know, you can rebuild that trust. And so it's an ongoing process, but it has gotten tremendously, tremendously easier. But at the same time, not to go, you know, too far, but the sad reality of this, and especially in, you know, the time that we're in right now with COVID and many of these things. I mean, the relapse rate right now is tremendously high. A lot of the support systems that are in place for recovery look a little bit different. More is virtual. There's maybe a little less connection. So, you know, sadly, I've had a lot of friends who have relapsed, and it's a reminder that I need to continue to work on this and never think that I've got it or it's over. You know, it's a lifelong process.
And I want to make sure that nobody thinks that because this book was written by Harry and me, and we have the chance to speak about it, and which has been an absolute joy for me to have this time with Harry writing the book. This was a family's journey, and we were surrounded by friends who are texting me right now, who just surrounded our family, surrounded Harry with love, without judgment, only cared about his coming back to health. My husband, PJ, Jim, you'll like this. He wrote a chapter for the book, which we submitted to the editor. His chapter was entitled, "I Was There Too." The editor summarily dismissed it, but I don't want anybody to get the impression that this was a one woman's battle or a one son's battle. This was a family event. Along with our loving friends and neighbor, Sean, that I'm shouting out to you because he's texting, "Where am I?" But know that it's not a solitary, this isn't a burden you carry on your shoulder alone if you are the loved one or if you are the one struggling with addiction. This is something that a whole village can help you through.
Mary Sweeten asks, "One thing that's been awful about recovery amid the pandemic, there is no Parents' Day or anything similar. Even Zoom is extremely limited because of HIPAA rules. One can imagine that however extraordinarily difficult this whole process is, it is more isolating during the pandemic, wouldn't you think?"
It is. I think about that from the family's point of view. It's really valuable for families to buy into this and to learn about the disease of addiction and to learn what recovery requires. And Harry, you can speak to it from your own work. But man, oh man, the involvement of parents or spouses or siblings or whomever is really important. So hopefully there are some substitutes, Zoom or otherwise, for the intense learning that everybody has to go through.
Kristen Carey, "Harry, how did you access pills and at what age?"
So I guess I started accessing them, you know, 14, 15 years old, maybe freshman, sophomore year in high school. They, you know, in terms of how at the time, they were accessible everywhere through friends, through people that I knew, through others in the school, kids in the neighborhood. The access was, you know, in hindsight, especially, you know, having younger kids now, terrifying, but they were easily and readily available, both through friends in school and also, you know, throughout many, many parts of Philadelphia where I would go and meet with, you know, people that I didn't know just to be able to access it. I was just going to say, you know, for me personally, you know, I never had a prescription or anything like that. It was, you know, from other dealers and friends.
From Terry Lynn, Harry, what is your opinion about the legalization of recreational marijuana? Interesting question that speaks to a huge issue. We've heard for so many years that marijuana is a gateway drug, and now we're seeing the legalization of small amounts of marijuana for recreational purposes. What's your opinion about all that?
So that's a really tough question right at 8:30, because there's a lot to say. You know, I think in terms of people shouldn't be criminally charged, you know, I think for possession and something like that. But what I will say, I think we need to be really careful of is the way that we're talking about it. There's not enough research done on the effects of it. And I think in many people's eyes, there's almost this view that the legalization is kind of saying that it's okay or that it's safe. You know, for me, it, you know, it definitely was a gateway to many more substances. And even before it was a gateway, it was a substance as a standalone that I really struggled with and could not put down and stop using. So I don't think anybody, you know, should be criminally liable for it, but I think we need to really allow more time and research to understand what the effects are and not rush to judgment that, that it's safe. You know, you look at alcohol, which is legal, and how many people are dying every year due to alcohol related, deaths. It's horrifying. So I think as a culture, you know, how we talk about these things is very complicated, especially given me only, you know, a minute or so, knowing we're running up against the clock. So a lot to digest there.
But for you, the timeline, the substance timeline was, if I recall correctly, alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, Percocet. So marijuana was definitely a major component to your addiction.
Absolutely. And I, you know, I see in my work all the time, people who are struggling with marijuana as a primary issue. So I think it's just, you know, you need to look at the full picture. I'm not a scientist or a doctor. I don't know all of the research myself, but I think we need to really carefully look at how we talk about it.
Madeline, I can't let you get away without your opinion about the legalization of marijuana.
I'm almost content to be quiet tonight because, as I said, I always learn from Harry. I was in the state legislature when we had the battle for medical marijuana, and I was a supporter of that by learning from families who cried out for the help, whether it was for pain relief or for non-opioid pain relief. People who are struggling with stage 4 cancers, for example. And so I was proud to be a part of that fight. And we passed medical marijuana in the Pennsylvania House and Senate. And of course, it became the law. I'm somebody who, and I literally am hearing and listening to Harry. I'm somebody who thinks that maybe if we legalize it, we will regulate it, we will tax it, and we will send those resources for greater care. But I really want to agree with Harry on the sense of let's understand it, let's do the research, let's put the money toward the research to understand it better. But just keeping something, a substance in the shadows and criminalizing it in an inequitable way, I'm certain is wrong.
We're going to have to stop. We have 16 more people lined up, queued up in the Q&A. So rather than me sort of summing this up, a woman by the name of Madeline Sherry writes, and she wrote this at 8:10. I don't have a question, but I just want to thank you for your incredible honesty and willingness to share your stories. Harry, I particularly loved when you talked about writing to get to the truth. You will help so many families with your stories. They are stories because you are both sharing your truths. Madeline, my name is pronounced the same as yours. Most people get the pronunciation wrong. I love hearing your name pronounced the right way, and my nickname is also Mad. Thank you both for your service. Madeline Sherry. And I can only echo what she said. Thank you for your truths, and thank you for your service. It's been a great hour. I've appreciated every minute of it. Thank you for asking me to take part. And thank you for your book.
Well, I'm going to say a quick thank you to Madeline. That's awfully nice. Nice to know another one. I'm named for my grandmother, Madeline Eaton. So I'm very lucky for the name. Nice to meet you, Madeline and Mad. Jim, I want to thank you and the Free Library. When Harry and I knew we had a chance at an interview with the Free Library, you were the very first person we thought of. You are somebody I know our region, our city, our whole region looks up to. So for you to ask us questions about our truth, our story, you have no idea how powerful that is to us. So a sincere thank you from me.
You're very kind. I don't know how to, I have a problem accepting compliments, but thank you very much. I appreciate your kind words and you're very generous. Harry, I feel like I know you. I think a lot of people who have read Under Our Roof feel like they know you. And, you know, I appreciate you. And I've appreciated this hour. Thank you so much. And thank you to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.